No honour, no glory, only blisters in unfortunate places. The belling of the hounds grew louder behind them, the pack of dogs howling for blood. Roran tightened his grip on the reins and bent lower over the neck of his galloping charger. The pounding of the horse's hooves rolled through him like thunder. He and his five men, Karn, Mandel, Baldur, Delwyn, and Hammund, had stolen fresh horses from the stable of a manor house less than a half mile away. The grooms had not taken kindly to the theft. A show of swords had been sufficient to overcome their objections, but the grooms must have alerted the manor guards as soon as Roran and his companions had departed, for 10 of the guards had set out after them, led by a pack of hunting dogs. "There!" he shouted, and pointed toward a narrow strip of birch trees that extended from between 2 nearby hills, no doubt following the path of a stream. At his word, the men pulled their horses off the well-travelled road and headed in the direction of the trees. The rough ground forced them to slow their headlong pace, but only slightly, despite the risk that the horses could step in a hole and break a leg or throw a rider. Dangerous as it was, allowing the hounds to catch them would be more dangerous still. Roran dug his spurs into the sides of the horse and shouted, "Yah!" as loudly as he could through his dust-clogged throat. The gelding leaped forward and, stride by stride, began to gain on Karn. Roran knew that his horse would soon reach a point where it could no longer produce such bursts of speed, no matter how hard he jabbed it with his spurs or whipped it with the ends of his reins. He hated to be cruel, and he had no desire to ride the animal to death, but he would not spare the horse if it meant the failure of their mission. As he drew level with Karn, Roran shouted, "Can't you hide our trail with a spell?"
"Don't know how,"
Karn replied, barely audible over the rush of wind and the sound of the galloping horses.
"It's too complicated."
Roran swore and glanced over his shoulder. The hounds were rounding the last bend in the road. They seemed to fly over the ground, their long, lean bodies lengthening and contracting at a violent rate. Even at that distance, Roran could make out the red of their tongues, and he fancied he saw a gleam of white fangs. When they reached the trees, Roran turned and began to ride back into the hills, staying as close as he could to the line of birches without hitting low-hanging branches or fallen logs. The others did likewise, shouting at their horses to keep them from slowing as they raced up the incline. To his right, Roran glimpsed Mandel hunched over his speckled mare, a feral snarl on his face. The younger man had impressed Roran with his stamina and fortitude over the past 3 days. Ever since Katrina's father, Sloane, had betrayed the villagers of Carvajal and killed Mandel's father, Bert, Mandel had seemed desperate to prove himself the equal of any man in the village. He had acquitted himself with honour in the last 2 battles between the Varden and the Empire. A thick branch hurtled toward Roran's head. He ducked, hearing and feeling the tips of dry twigs snapping against the top of his helm. A torn leaf tumbled down his face and covered his right eye for a moment. Then the wind snatched it away. The gelding's breathing became increasingly laboured as they followed the rift deeper into the hills. Roran peeked under his arm and saw that the pack of hounds was less than a quarter mile away. Another few minutes and they would surely overtake the horses.
"Blast it!" he thought.
He raked his gaze back and forth across the densely packed trees to his left and the grassy hill to his right, searching for something, anything, that could help them lose their pursuers. He was so fuzzy-headed from exhaustion, he almost missed it. 20 yards ahead of him, a crooked deer trail ran down the side of the hill, crossed his path, then disappeared into the trees.
"Whoa! Whoa!"
Roran shouted, leaning back in his stirrups and hauling on the reins. The gelding slowed to a trot, though it snorted with protest and tossed its head, trying to get the bit between its teeth.
"Oh, no you don't," Roran growled, and tugged on the reins even harder.
"Hurry!"
he called to the rest of the group as he turned his horse and entered the thicket. The air was cool under the trees, almost chilly, which was a welcome relief, hot as he was from his exertion. He only had a moment to savour the sensation before the gelding pitched forward and began to stumble down the side of the bank toward the stream below. Dead leaves crackled under its iron-shod hooves. In order not to fall over the horse's neck and head, Roran had to lie almost flat against its back, his legs stuck out straight in front of him,
knees locked. When they reached the bottom of the gorge, the gelding clattered across the stony creek, splashing wings of water as high as Roran's knees. Roran paused at the far side to see whether the others were still with him. They were, riding nose to tail down through the trees. Above them, where they had entered the thicket, he could hear the yapping of the dogs. "We're going to have to turn and fight," he realized. He swore again and spurred the gelding away from the stream, climbing the soft, moss-covered bank as he continued along the faintly marked trail. Not far from the stream was a wall of ferns, and beyond that a hollow. Roran spotted a fallen tree that he thought might serve as a makeshift barrier if it could be dragged into place. "I just hope they don't have bows," he thought. He waved at his men. "Here!" With a slap of the reins, he drove the gelding through the bracken and into the hollow, then slid out of the saddle, though he kept a tight hold on it. As his feet struck the ground, his legs gave out beneath him, and he would have fallen if not for the support. He grimaced and pressed his forehead against the shoulder of the horse, panting as he waited for the tremors in his legs to subside. The rest of the group crowded around him, filling the air with the stink of sweat and the jingle of harnesses. The horses shuddered, their chests heaving, and yellow foam dripped from the corners of their mouths. "Help me," he said to Baldur, and motioned at the fallen tree. They fit their hands under the thick end of the log and heaved it off the ground. Roran gritted his teeth as his back and thighs screamed with pain. Riding at full gallop for 3 days, combined with less than 3 hours of sleep for every 12 spent in the saddle, had left him frighteningly weak. "I might as well be going into battle drunk, sick, and beaten half out of my senses," Roran realized as he let go of the log and straightened upright. The thought unnerved him. The 6 men positioned themselves in front of the horses, facing the trampled wall of ferns, and drew their weapons. Outside the hollow, the hunting cries of the hounds sounded louder than ever, their overeager yelps echoing off the trees in a raucous din. Roran tensed and lifted his hammer higher. Then, interspersed with the barking of the dogs, he heard the strange, lilting melody of the ancient language emanating from Khan, and the power contained within the phrases caused the back of Roran's neck to prickle with alarm. The spellcaster uttered several lines in a short, breathless manner, speaking so quickly the words melded together into an indistinct babble. As soon as he finished, he gestured at Roran and the others, and said in a strained whisper, "Get down!" Without question, Roran dropped to his haunches. Not for the first time, he cursed the fact that he was unable to use magic himself. Of all the skills a warrior could possess, none was more useful. Lacking it left him at the mercy of those who could reshape the world with nothing more than their will and a word. The ferns in front of him rustled and shook. Then a hound pushed its black-tipped snout through the foliage and peered at the hollow, nose twitching. Delwyn hissed and raised his sword as if to behead the dog, but Khan made an urgent noise in his throat and waved at him until he lowered his blade. The dog furrowed its brow, appearing puzzled. It scented the air again, then licked its jowls with its engorged purplish tongue and withdrew. As the fronds sprang back over the dog's face, Roran slowly released the breath he had been holding. He looked at Khan and raised an eyebrow, hoping for an explanation. But Khan just shook his head and placed a finger over his lips. A few seconds later, 2 more dogs wiggled their way through the undergrowth to inspect the hollow. Then, like the first one, they backed out after a short while. Soon the pack began to whine and yip as they cast about among the trees, trying to figure out where their prey had gone. As he sat waiting, Roran noticed that his leggings were mottled with several dark blotches along the inside of his thighs. He touched one of the discolored areas, and his fingers came away with a film of bloody liquid. Each blotch marked the location of a blister. Nor were they his only ones. He could feel blisters on his hands, where the reins had chafed the web of skin between his thumbs and forefingers, and on his heels, and in other more uncomfortable places. With an expression of distaste, he wiped his fingers against the ground. He looked at his men, at how they crouched and knelt, and he saw the discomfort on their faces whenever they moved, and the slightly twisted grips with which they held their weapons. They were in no better condition than he was. Roran decided that when they next stopped to sleep, he would have Khan heal their sores. If the magician seemed too tired, however, Roran would refrain from having his own blisters healed. He would rather endure the pain than allow Khan to expend all of his strength before they arrived at Aros, for Roran suspected that Khan's skills might very well prove useful in capturing the city. Thinking of Aros and of the siege he was somehow supposed to win caused Roran to press his free hand against his breast to check that the packet containing the orders he could not read and the commission he doubted he would be able to keep were still safely tucked in his tunic. They were. After several long, tense minutes, one of the hounds began to bark excitedly somewhere in the trees upstream. The other dogs rushed in that direction and resumed the deep-chested baying that meant they were in close pursuit of their quarry. When the clamour had receded, Roran slowly rose to his full height and swept his gaze over the trees and bushes. "All clear," he said, keeping his voice subdued. As the others stood, Hammond, who was tall and shaggy-haired and had deep lines next to his mouth, although he was only a year older than Roran, turned on Khan, scowling, and said,
"Why couldn't you have done that before, instead of letting us go riding willy-nilly over the countryside and almost breaking our necks coming down that hill?"
He motioned back toward the stream. Khan responded with an equally angry tone.
"Because I hadn't thought of it yet, that's why. Given that I just saved you the inconvenience of having a host of small holes poked in your hide, I would think you might show a bit of gratitude."
"Is that so? Well, I think that you ought to spend more time working on your spells before we're chased halfway to who knows where, and..."
Fearing that their argument could turn dangerous, Roran stepped between them.
"Enough," he said. Then he asked Khan, "Will your spell hide us from the guards?"
Khan shook his head.
"Men are harder to fool than dogs."
He cast a disparaging look at Hammond.
"Most of them, at least. I can hide us, but I can't hide our trail."
And he indicated the crushed and broken ferns, as well as the hoofprints gouged into the damp soil.
"They'll know we're here. If we leave before they catch sight of us, the dogs will draw them off and we'll..."
"Mount up,"
Roran ordered. With an assortment of half-muttered curses and poorly concealed groans, the men climbed back onto their steeds. Roran glanced over the hollow one last time to make sure that they had not forgotten anything, then guided his charger to the head of the group and tapped the horse with his spurs. And together they galloped out from under the shadow of the trees and away from the ravine, as they resumed their seemingly never-ending journey to Aros. What he would do once they reached the city, though, Roran had not the slightest idea.
Mooneater. Aragorn rolled his shoulders as he walked through the Varden's camp, trying to work out the kink in his neck that he had acquired while sparring with Arya and Blodgarm earlier that afternoon. As he topped a small hill, which stood like a lone island amid the sea of tents, he rested his hands on his hips and paused to take in the view. Before him lay the dark spread of Leona Lake, gleaming in the twilight as the crests of the shallow waves reflected the orange torchlight from the camp. The road the Varden had been following lay between the tents and the shore, a broad strip of paving stones set with mortar that had been constructed, or so Jode had informed him, long before Galbatorix had overthrown the riders. A quarter mile to the north, a small, squat fishing village sat close against the water. Aragorn knew its inhabitants were far from happy that an army was camped on their doorstep.
"You must learn to see what you are looking at."
Since leaving Bellatona, Aragorn had spent hours pondering Glaeder's advice. He was not certain exactly what the dragon had meant by it, as Glaeder had refused to say anything more after delivering his enigmatic statement. So Aragorn had chosen to interpret his instruction literally. He had striven to truly see everything before him, no matter how small or apparently insignificant, and to understand the meaning of that which he beheld. Try though he might, he felt as if he failed miserably. Wherever he looked, he saw an overwhelming amount of detail, but he was convinced there was even more that he was not perceptive enough to notice. Worse, he was rarely able to make sense of what he was aware of, like why there was no smoke rising from three of the chimneys in the fishing village. Despite his sense of futility, the effort had proved helpful in at least one regard.
Arya no longer defeated him every time they crossed blades. He had watched her with redoubled attention, studying her as closely as a deer he was stalking, and as a result, he had won a few of their matches. However, he still was not her equal, much less a better. And he did not know what he needed to learn, or who could teach him, in order to become as skilled with a blade as she was. "Perhaps Arya is right. An experience is the only mentor that can help me now," Aragorn thought. "Experience requires time, though, and time is what I have the least of. We'll be at Drasleona soon, and then Urabane. A few months at the most, and we'll have to face Galbatorix and Shrukan." He sighed and rubbed his face, trying to turn his mind in other, less troubling directions. Always, he returned to the same set of doubts, worrying at them like a dog with a marrow bone, only with nothing to show for it, other than a constant and increasing sense of anxiety. Lost in rumination, he continued down the hill. He wandered among the shadowy tents, heading generally toward his own, but paying little attention to his exact path. As it invariably did, walking helped calm him. The men who were still about moved aside for him when they met, and clapped a fist against their chests, usually accompanied by a soft greeting of "Shadeslayer," to which Aragorn responded with a polite nod. He had been walking for a quarter hour, stopping and starting in counterpoint to his thoughts, when the high-pitched tone of a woman describing something with great enthusiasm interrupted his reverie. Curious, he followed the sound until he arrived at a tent set apart from the rest, near the base of a gnarled willow tree, the only tree near the lake that the army had not chopped down for firewood. There, under the ceiling of branches, was the strangest sight he had ever seen. 12 Urgals, including their war chief, Nar Garjvag, sat in a semicircle around a low, flickering campfire. Fearsome shadows danced on their faces, emphasizing their heavy brows, broad cheekbones, and massive jaws, as well as the ridges on their horns, which sprouted from their foreheads and curved back and around the sides of their heads. The Urgals were bare-armed and bare-chested, except for the leather cuffs on their wrists and the woven straps they wore slung from shoulder to waist. In addition to Garjvag, 3 other Kull were present. Their hulking size made the rest of the Urgals, not one of whom was under 6 feet tall, appear childishly small. Scattered among the Urgals, among and on them, were several dozen werecats in their animal forms. Many of the cats sat upright before the fire, utterly still, not even moving their tails. Their tufted ears pricked forward attentively. Others lay sprawled on the ground, or on the Urgals' laps, or in their arms. To Aragorn's astonishment, he even spotted one werecat, a slim white female, resting curled atop the broad head of a Kull, her right foreleg draped over the edge of his skull, and her paw pressed possessively against the middle of his brow. Tiny though the werecats were compared to the Urgals, they looked equally savage, and Aragorn had no doubt whom he would rather face in battle. Urgals, he understood, whereas werecats were unpredictable. On the other side of the fire, in front of the tent, was the herbalist Angela. She was sitting cross-legged on a folded blanket, spinning a pile of carded wool into fine thread, using a drop spindle, which she held out before her as if to entrance those who were watching. Both werecats and Urgals stared at her intently, their eyes never leaving her as she said, "But he was too slow, and the raging red-eyed rabbit ripped out Hord's throat, killing him instantly. Then the hare fled into the forest and out of recorded history. However," and here Angela leaned forward and lowered her voice, "if you travel through those parts, as I have, sometimes, even to this day, you will come across a freshly killed deer or feldunost that looks as if it has been nibbled at like a turnip. And all around it, you'll see the prints of an unusually large rabbit. Every now and then, a warrior from K'voth will go missing, only to be found lying dead with his throat torn out. Always with his throat torn out." She resumed her former position. "Terran was horribly upset by the loss of his friend, of course, and he wanted to chase after the hare, but the dwarves still needed his help. So he returned to the stronghold, and for 3 more days and 3 more nights the defenders held the walls until their supplies were low and every warrior was covered in wounds. At last, on the morning of the 4th day, when all seemed hopeless, the clouds parted, and far in the distance, Terran was amazed to see Mimring flying toward the stronghold at the head of a huge thunder of dragons. The sight of the dragons frightened the attackers so much they threw down their weapons and fled into the wilderness.
Angela's mouth quirked.
This, as you can imagine, made the dwarves of Quoth rather happy, and there was much rejoicing. And when Mimring landed, Terran saw, much to his surprise, that his scales had become clear as diamonds, which it is said happened because Mimring flew so close to the sun. For in order to fetch the other dragons in time, he had had to fly over the peaks of the Beor Mountains, higher than any dragon has ever flown before, or since. From then on, Terran was known as the hero of the Siege of Kavoth, and his dragon was known as Mimring the Brilliant, on account of his scales, and they lived happily ever after. Although, if truth be told, Terran always remained rather afraid of rabbits, even into his old age. And that is what really happened at Kavoth.
As she fell silent, the weercats began to purr, and the Urgles uttered several low grunts of approval.
"You tell a good story, Ulu-Threk," Garshvag said, his voice sounding like the rumble of falling rock.
"Thank you. But not as I have heard it told," Aragorn commented, as he stepped into the light. Angela's expression brightened. "Well, you can hardly expect the dwarves to admit they were at the mercy of a rabbit. Have you been lurking in the shadows this whole time?"
"Only for a minute," he confessed.
"Then you missed the best part of the story, and I'm not about to repeat myself tonight. My throat is too dry now for talking at length."
Aragorn felt the vibration through the soles of his boots as the Cull and the other Urgles got to their feet, much to the displeasure of the weercats resting on them, several of whom uttered yowls of protest as they dropped to the ground. As he gazed at the collection of grotesque, horned faces gathered around the fire, Aragorn had to suppress the urge to grasp the hilt of his sword. Even after having fought, travelled, and hunted alongside the Urgles, and even after having sifted through the thoughts of several of them, being in their presence still gave him pause. He knew in his mind that they were allies, but his bones and his muscles could not forget the visceral terror that had gripped him during the numerous occasions when he had confronted their kind in battle. Garshvag removed something from the leather pouch he wore on his belt. Extending his thick arm over the fire, he handed it to Angela, who set down her spinning to accept the object with cupped hands. It was a rough orb of sea-green crystal, which twinkled like crusted snow. She slipped it inside the sleeve of her garment, then picked up her drop spindle.
Garshvag said, "You must come to our camp sometime, Ulu-Threk, and we will tell you many stories of our own. We have a chanter with us. He is good. When you listen to him recite the tale of Nar-Tukwa's victory at Stavarosk, your blood grows hot, and you feel like bellowing at the moon and locking horns with even the strongest of your foes."
"That would depend on whether you have horns to lock," said Angela. "I would be honoured to sit with you. Perhaps tomorrow evening?"
The giant Cull agreed. Then Aragorn asked, "Where is Stavarosk? I've not heard of it before." The Urgles shifted uneasily, and Garshvag lowered his head and snorted like a bull.
"What trickery is this, Firesword?" he demanded. "Do you seek to challenge me by insulting us so?"
He opened and closed his hands with unmistakable menace.
"Wary," Aragorn said. "I meant no harm, Nar-Garshvag. It was an honest question. I've never heard the name of Stavarosk before."
A murmur of surprise spread among the Urgles.
"How can this be?" said Garshvag. Do not all humans know of Stavorosk? Is it not sung of in every hall, from the northern wastes to the Bjorm Mountains, as our greatest triumph? Surely, if nowhere else, the Varden must speak of it.
Angela sighed, and without looking up from her spinning, said, You'd best tell them. In the back of his mind, Aragorn felt Saphira watching their exchange, and he knew that she was readying herself to fly from their tent to his side if a fight became unavoidable. Choosing his words with care, he said, No one has mentioned it to me, but then I have not been with the Varden for very long, and—
Drajal, swore Garjvag. The lack-horned betrayer does not even have the courage to admit his own defeat. He is a coward and a liar.
Who? Galbatorix? Aragorn asked cautiously. A number of the weercats hissed at the mention of the king. Garjvag nodded.
Aye. When he came to power, he sought to destroy our race forever. He sent a vast army into the Spine. His soldiers crushed our villages, burned our bones, and left the earth black and bitter behind them. We fought, at first with joy, then with despair, but still we fought. It was the only thing we could do. There was nowhere for us to run, nowhere to hide. Who would protect the Orgralgra when even the riders had been brought to their knees? We were lucky, though. We had a great war chief to lead us, Nartuqua. He had once been captured by humans, and he had spent many years fighting them, so he knew how you think. Because of that, he was able to rally many of our tribes under his banner. Then he lured Galbatorix's army into a narrow passage deep within the mountains, and our rams fell upon them from either side. It was a slaughter, Firesword. The ground was wet with blood, and the piles of bodies stood higher than my head. Even to this day, if you go to Stavorosk, you will feel the bones cracking under your feet, and you will find coins and swords and pieces of armor under every patch of moss.
So it was you, Aragorn exclaimed. All my life I've heard it said that Galbatorix once lost half his men in the Spine, but no one could tell me how or why.
More than half his men, Firesword.
Garjvag rolled his shoulders and made a guttural noise in the back of his throat.
And now I see we must work to spread word of it, if any are to know of our victory. We will track down your chanters, your bards, and we will teach them the songs concerning Nartuqua, and we will make sure that they remember to recite them often and loudly.
He nodded once, as if his mind was made up, an impressive gesture, considering the ponderous size of his head, then said,
Farewell, Firesword. Farewell, Ulúthrek.
Then he and his warriors lumbered off into the darkness. Angela chuckled, startling Aragorn. What? He asked, turning to her. She smiled. I'm imagining the expression some poor lute player is going to have in a few minutes when he looks out his tent and sees 12 Urgals, 4 of them Kull, standing outside, eager to give him an education in Urgal culture. I'll be impressed if we don't hear him scream. She chuckled again. Similarly amused, Aragorn lowered himself to the ground and stirred the coals with the end of a branch. A warm, heavy weight settled in his lap, and he looked down to see the white weercat curled up on his legs. He raised a hand to pet her, then thought better of it and asked the cat, May I? The weercat flicked her tail but otherwise ignored him. Hoping that he was not doing the wrong thing, Aragorn tentatively began to rub the creature's neck. A moment later, a loud, throbbing purr filled the night air. She likes you, Angela observed. For some reason, Aragorn felt inordinately pleased. Who is she? I mean, that is, who are you? What is your name? He cast a quick glance at the weercat, worried that he had offended her. Angela laughed quietly. Her name is Shadowhunter. Or rather, that is what her name means in the language of the weercats. Properly, she is... Here the herbalist uttered a strange, coughing, growling sound that made the nape of Aragorn's neck crawl. Shadowhunter is mated to Grimmer Halfpaw, so one might say that she is queen of the weercats. The purring increased in volume. I see. Aragorn looked around at the other weercats. Where is Sonnenbaum? Busy chasing a long-whiskered female who is half his age. He's acting as foolish as a kitten. But then everyone's entitled to a little foolishness once in a while. Catching the spindle with her left hand, she stopped its motion and wound the newly formed thread around the base of the wooden disc. Then she gave the spindle a twist to start it spinning again and resumed drafting from the bat of wool in her other hand. You look as if you are full to bursting with questions, Shadeslayer. Whenever I meet you, I always end up feeling more confused than before. Always? That's rather absolutist of you. Very well, I will attempt to be informative. Ask away. Skeptical of her apparent openness, Aragorn considered what he would like to know. Finally, a thunder of dragons? What did you... That is the proper term for a flock of dragons. If ever you had heard one in full flight, you would understand. When 10, 12 or more dragons flew past overhead, the very air would reverberate around you as if you were sitting inside a giant drum. Besides, what else could you call a group of dragons? You have your murder of ravens, your convocation of eagles, your gaggle of geese, your raft of ducks, your band of jays, your parliament of owls, and so on. But what about dragons? A hunger of dragons? That doesn't sound quite right. Nor does referring to them as a blaze or a terror. Although I'm rather fond of terror, all things considered. A terror of dragons. But no, a flock of dragons is called a thunder. Which you would know if your education had consisted of more than just learning how to swing a sword and conjugate a few verbs in the ancient language. I'm sure you're right, he said, humouring her. Through his ever-present link with Zephira, he sensed her approval of the phrase, a thunder of dragons, an opinion he shared. It was a fitting description. He thought for a moment longer, then asked, And why did Garshvag call you Uluthrek? It is the title the Urgals gave me long, long ago, when I travelled among them. What does it mean? Moon-eater. Moon-eater? What a strange name. How did you come by it? I ate the moon, of course. How else? Aragorn frowned and concentrated on petting the weercat for a minute. Then, why did Garshvag give you that stone? Because I told him a story. I thought that was obvious. But what is it? A piece of rock, didn't you notice? She clucked with disapproval. Really, you ought to pay better attention to what's going on around you. Otherwise, someone's liable to stick a knife in you when you're not looking. And then whom would I exchange cryptic remarks with? She tossed her hair. Go on, ask me another question. I'm rather enjoying this game. He cocked an eyebrow at her, and although he was certain it was pointless, he said, Cheep, cheep. The herbalist brayed with laughter, and some of the weercats opened their mouths in what appeared to be toothy smiles. However, Shadowhunter seemed displeased, for she dug her claws into Aragorn's legs, making him wince. Well, said Angela, still laughing, if you must have answers, that's as good a story as any. Let's see. Several years ago, when I was travelling along the edge of Duweldenvarden, way out to the west, miles and miles from any city, town or village, I happened upon Grimmer. At the time, he was only the leader of a small tribe of weercats, and he still had full use of both his paws. Anyway, I found him toying with a fledgling robin that had fallen out of its nest in a nearby tree. I wouldn't have minded if he had just killed the bird and eaten it. That's what cats are supposed to do, after all. But he was torturing the poor thing, pulling on its wings, nibbling its tail, letting it hop away, then knocking it over. Angela wrinkled her nose with distaste. I told him that he ought to stop, but he only growled and ignored me. She fixed Aragon with a stern gaze. I don't like it when people ignore me. So I took the bird away from him, and I wiggled my fingers and cast a spell. And for the next week, whenever he opened his mouth, he chirped like a songbird. He chirped? Angela nodded, beaming with suppressed mirth. I've never laughed so hard in my life. None of the other weircats would go anywhere near him for the whole week. No wonder he hates you. What of it? If you don't make a few enemies every now and then, you're a coward. Or worse. Besides, it was worth it to see his reaction. Oh, he was angry. Shadowhunter uttered a soft, warning growl and tightened her claws again. Grimacing, Aragon said, Maybe it would be best to change the subject. Before he could suggest a new topic, a loud scream rang out from somewhere in the middle of the camp. The cry echoed three times over the rows of tents, before fading into silence. Aragon looked at Angela and she at him, and then they both began to laugh. Rumours and Writing.
It's late, said Saphira, as Aragon sauntered toward his tent, beside which she lay coiled, sparkling like a mound of azure coals in the dim light of the torches. She regarded him with a single, heavy-lidded eye. He crouched by her head and pressed his brow against hers for several moments, hugging her spiky jaw. So it is, he said at last, and you need your rest after flying into the wind all day. Sleep, and I'll see you in the morning. She blinked once in acknowledgement. Inside his tent, Aragon lit a single candle for comfort. Then he pulled off his boots and sat on his cot, with his legs folded under him. He slowed his breathing and allowed his mind to open and expand outward, to touch all of the living things around him, from the worms and the insects in the ground, to Saphira and the warriors of the Varden, and even the few remaining plants nearby, the energy from which was pale and hard to see, compared with the burning brilliance of even the smallest animal. For a long while he sat there, empty of thoughts, aware of a thousand sensations, the sharp and the subtle, concentrating on nothing but the steady inflow and outflow of air in his lungs. Off in the distance, he heard men talking as they stood around a watchfire. The night air carried their voices farther than they intended, far enough that his keen ears were able to make out their words. He could sense their minds as well, and he could have read their thoughts had he wanted, but instead he chose to respect their innermost privacy and merely listen. A deep-voiced fellow was saying, And the way they stare down their noses at you, as if you're the lowest of the low. Half the time they won't even talk to you when you ask them a friendly question. They just turn their shoulder and walk away. Aye, said another man, and they're women, as beautiful as statues and about half as inviting. That's because you're a right ugly bastard, Sven, that's why. It's not my fault my father had a habit of seducing milkmaids wherever he went. Besides, you're hardly one to point fingers. You could give children nightmares with that face of yours. The deep-voiced warrior grunted. Then someone coughed and spat, and Aragon heard the sizzle of moisture evaporating as it struck a piece of burning wood. A third speaker entered the conversation. I don't like the elves any more than you do, but we need them to win this war. What if they turn on us afterward, though? Asked the deep-voiced man. Hear, hear, added Svean. Look what happened in Sihunon and Gilead. All his men, all his power, and Galbatorix still couldn't stop them from swarming over the walls. Maybe he wasn't trying, suggested the third speaker. A long pause followed. Then the deep-voiced man said, Now there's a singularly unpleasant thought. Still, whether he was or wasn't, I don't see how we could hold off the elves if they decided to reclaim their old territories. They're faster and stronger than we are, and unlike us, there's not one of them who can't use magic. Ah, but we have Aragon, Sven countered.
He could drive them back to their forest all by himself if he wanted to.
Him? There. He looks more like an elf than he does his own flesh and blood. I wouldn't count on his loyalty any more than the Urgles.
The third man spoke up again.
Have you noticed? He's always freshly shaven, no matter how early in the morning we break camp. He must use magic for a razor.
Goes against the natural order of things, it does. That and all the other spells being tossed around nowadays. Makes you want to hide in a cave somewhere and let the magicians kill each other off without any interference from us.
I don't seem to recall you complaining when the healers used a spell instead of a pair of tongs to remove that arrow from your shoulder.
Maybe, but the arrow never would have ended up in my shoulder if it weren't for Galbatorix. And it's him and his magic that's caused this whole mess.
Someone snorted.
True enough, but I'd bet every last copper I have that Galbatorix or no, you still would have ended up with an arrow sticking out of you. You're too mean to do anything other than fight. Aragorn saved my life in Feinster, you know, said Sven.
Aye,
and if you bore us with the story one more time, I'll have you scrubbing pots for a week.
Well, he did.
There was another silence, which was broken when the deep-voiced warrior sighed.
We need a way to protect ourselves, that's the problem. We're at the mercy of the elves, the magicians, ours and theirs, and every other strange creature that roams the land.
It's all well and fine for the likes of Aragorn, but we're not so fortunate. What we need is...
What we need, said Sven, are the riders. They'd put the world in order.
With what dragons?
You can't have riders without dragons.
Besides, we still wouldn't be able to defend ourselves, and that's what bothers me. I'm not a child to go hiding behind my mother's skirts, but if a shade were to appear out of the night, there isn't a blasted thing we could do to keep it from tearing our heads off.
That reminds me, did you hear about Lord Bast?
Asked the third man. Sven uttered a sound of agreement.
I heard he ate his heart afterward.
What's this now? Asked the deep-voiced warrior.
Bast.
Bast?
You know, the earl with an estate up by Gilead.
Isn't he the one who drove his horses into the rammer just to spite?
Aye, that's the one. Anyway, so he goes to this village and orders all the men to join Galbatorix's army. Same story as always. Only the men refuse, and they attack Bast and his soldiers.
Brave, said the deep-voiced man. Stupid, but brave.
Well, Bast was too clever for them. He had archers posted around the village before he went in. The soldiers kill half the men and thrash the rest within an inch of their lives. No surprise there. Then Bast takes the leader, the man who started the fight, and he grabs him by the neck, and with his bare hands, he pulls his head right off.
No.
Like a chicken. And what's worse, he ordered the man's family burned alive as well.
Bast must be as strong as an Urgle to tear off a man's head, said Sven.
Maybe there's a trick to it.
Could it be magic? Asked the deep-voiced man.
By all accounts, he's always been strong. Strong and smart. When he was just a young man, he's said to have killed a wounded ox with a single blow of his fist.
Still sounds like magic to me.
That's because you see evil magicians lurking in every shadow, you do.
The deep-voiced warrior grunted, but did not speak. After that, the men dispersed to walk their rounds, and Aragorn heard nothing more from them. At any other time, their conversation might have disturbed him, but because of his meditation, he remained unperturbed throughout, although he made an effort to remember what they said, so that he could consider it properly later. Once his thoughts were in order, and he felt calm and relaxed, Aragorn closed off his mind, opened his eyes, and slowly unfolded his legs, working the stiffness out of his muscles. The motion of the candle flame caught his eye, and he stared at it for a minute, enthralled by the contortions of the fire. Then he went over to where he had dropped Saphira's saddlebags earlier, and removed the quill, the brush, the bottle of ink, and the sheets of parchment that he had begged off Jode several days before, as well as the copy of Domia Aberwyrda that the old scholar had given him. Returning to the cot, Aragorn placed the heavy book well away from him, so as to minimize the chances of spilling ink on it. He laid his shield across his knees like a tray, and spread the sheets of parchment over the curved surface. A sharp, tannic odor filled his nostrils as he unstoppered the bottle and dipped the quill into the oak gall ink. He touched the nib of the feather against the lip of the bottle to draw off the excess liquid, then carefully made his first stroke. The quill produced a faint scratching sound as he wrote out the runes of his native language. When he finished, he compared them to his efforts from the previous night to see if his handwriting had improved. Only a small amount, as well as to the runes in Domia Averwirda, which he was using as his guide. He went through the alphabet 3 more times, paying special attention to the shapes that he had the most difficulty forming. Then he began to write down his thoughts and observations concerning the day's events. The exercise was useful not only because it provided him with a convenient means of practicing his letters, but also because it helped him better understand everything he had seen and done over the course of the day. Laborious as it was, he enjoyed the writing, for he found the challenges it presented stimulating. Also, it reminded him of Brom, of how the old storyteller had taught him the meaning of each rune, which gave Aragorn a sense of closeness with his father that otherwise eluded him. After he had said everything he wished to say, he washed the quill clean, then exchanged it for the brush, and selected a sheet of parchment that was already half-covered with rows of glyphs from the ancient language. The elves' mode of writing, the Liduan Kvedi, was far harder to reproduce than the runes of his own race, owing to the glyphs' intricate flowing shapes. Nevertheless, he persisted for 2 reasons. He needed to maintain his familiarity with the script, and if he was going to write anything in the ancient language, he thought it wiser to do it in a form that most people were unable to understand. Aragorn had a good memory, but even so, he had found he was starting to forget many of the spells Brom and Oromis had taught him. Thus he had decided to compile a dictionary of every word he knew in the ancient language. Although it was hardly an original idea, he had not appreciated the value of such a compendium until very recently. He worked on the dictionary for another few hours, whereupon he returned his writing supplies to the saddlebags and took out the chest containing Gleda's Heart of Hearts. He tried to rouse the old dragon from his stupor as he had so many times before, and as always, he failed. Aragorn refused to give up, however. Sitting next to the open chest, he read aloud to Gleda from Domia Averwirda, about the dwarves' many rites and rituals, few of which Aragorn was familiar with, until it was the coldest, darkest part of the night. Then Aragorn set aside the book, extinguished the candle, and lay down on the cot to rest. He wandered through the fantastic visions of his waking dreams for only a short while. Once the first hint of light appeared in the east, he rolled upright to begin the whole cycle anew.
Aros. It was mid-morning when Roran and his men arrived at the cluster of tents next to the road. The camp appeared grey and indistinct through the haze of exhaustion that clouded Roran's vision. A mile to the south lay the city of Aros, but he was able to make out only the most general features. Glacier white walls, yawning entryways containing barred gates, and many thickly built square stone towers. He clung to the front of the saddle as they trotted into the camp, their horses near to collapsing. A scraggly-looking youngster ran up to him and grabbed the bridle of his mare, pulling on it until the animal stumbled to a stop. Roran stared down at the boy, not sure what had just happened, and after a long moment croaked, "Bring me Brigman." Without a word, the boy took off between the tents, kicking up dust with his bare heels. It seemed to Roran that he sat waiting for over an hour. The mare's uncontrollable panting matched the rushing of blood in his ears. When he looked at the ground, it appeared as if it was still moving, receding tunnel-like toward a point infinitely far away. Somewhere spurs clinked. A dozen or so warriors gathered nearby, leaning on spears and shields, their faces open displays of curiosity. From across the camp, a broad-shouldered man in a blue tunic
limped toward Roran, using a broken spear as a staff. He had a large, full beard, though his upper lip was shaved, and it glittered with perspiration. Whether from pain or heat, Roran could not tell.
"You're Stronghammer," he said.
Roran grunted an affirmative. He released his cramped grip on the saddle, reached inside his tunic, and handed Brigman the battered rectangle of parchment that contained his orders from Nasuada. Brigman broke the wax seal with his thumbnail. He studied the parchment, then lowered it, and gazed at Roran with a flat expression.
"We've been expecting you," he said. "One of Nasuada's pet spellcasters contacted me 4 days ago and said you had departed, but I didn't think you would arrive so soon."
"It wasn't easy," said Roran. Brigman's bare upper lip curled.
"No, I'm sure it wasn't, sir."
He handed the parchment back.
"The men are yours to command, Stronghammer. But we're about to launch an attack on the Western Gate. Perhaps you would care to lead the charge."
The question was as pointed as a dagger. The world seemed to tilt around Roran, and he gripped the saddle tighter. He was too tired to bandy words with anyone and do it well, and he knew it. "Order them to stand down for the day," he said.
"Have you lost your wits? How else do you expect us to capture the city? It took us all morning to prepare the attack, and I'm not going to sit here twiddling my thumbs while you catch up on your sleep. Nasuada expects us to end this siege within a few days, and by Angvard, I'll see it done."
In a voice pitched so low that only Brigman could hear, Roran growled, "You'll tell the men to stand down, or I'll have you strung up by your ankles and whipped for breaking orders. I'm not about to approve any sort of attack until I've had a chance to rest and look at the situation."
"You're a fool, you are. If you can't hold your tongue and do your duty, I'll thrash you myself, right here and now."
Brigman's nostrils flared.
"In your state, you wouldn't stand a chance."
"You're wrong," said Roran, and he meant it. He was not sure how he might beat Brigman right then, but he knew in the deepest fibres of his being that he could. Brigman seemed to struggle with himself.
"Fine," he spat. "It wouldn't be good for the men to see us sprawling in the dirt anyway. We'll stay where we are, if that's what you want, but I won't be held accountable for the waste of time. Be it on your head, not mine."
"As it always is," said Roran, his throat tight with pain as he swung down from the mare.
"Just as you're responsible for the mess you've made of this siege."
Brigman's brow darkened, and Roran saw the man's dislike of him curdle and turn to hate. He wished that he had chosen a more diplomatic response.
"Your tent is this way."
It was still morning when Roran woke. A soft light diffused through the tent, lifting his spirits. For a moment he thought he had only fallen asleep for a few minutes. Then he realized he felt too bright and alert for that to be the case. He cursed quietly to himself, angry that he had allowed an entire day to slip through his fingers. A thin blanket covered him, mostly unneeded in the balmy southern weather, especially since he was wearing his boots and clothes underneath. He pulled it off, then tried to sit upright. A choked groan escaped him, as his entire body seemed to stretch and tear. He fell back and lay gasping at the fabric above. The initial shock soon subsided, but it left behind a multitude of throbbing aches, some worse than others. It took him several minutes to gather his strength. With a massive effort, he rolled onto his side and swung his legs over the edge of the cot. He stopped to catch his breath before attempting the seemingly impossible task of standing. Once he was on his feet, he smiled sourly. It was going to be an interesting day. The others were already up and waiting for him when he made his way out of the tent. They looked worn and haggard. Their movements were as stiff as his own. After exchanging greetings, Roran motioned toward the bandage on Delwyn's forearm, where a tavern keeper had cut him with a paring knife. "Has the pain gone down?"
Delwyn shrugged. "It's not so bad. I can fight if need be."
"Good."
"What do you intend to do first?"
Khan asked. Roran eyed the rising sun, calculating how much time remained until noon. "Take a walk," he said.
Starting from the centre of the camp, Roran led his companions up and down each row of tents, inspecting the condition of the troops, as well as the state of their equipment. Occasionally he stopped to question a warrior before moving on. For the most part, the men were tired and disheartened, although he noticed their mood seemed to improve when they caught sight of him. Roran's tour ended at the southern edge of the camp, as he had planned. There, he and the others stopped to gaze at the imposing edifice that was Aros. The city had been built in two tiers. The first was low and spread out, and contained the majority of buildings, while the second, smaller tier, occupied the top of a long, gentle rise, which was the tallest point for miles around. A wall encircled both levels of the city. Five gates were visible within the outer wall. Two of them opened to roads that entered the city, one from the north and one from the east, and the other three sat astride canals that flowed southward into the city. On the other side of Aros lay the restless sea, where the canals presumably emptied. At least they don't have a moat, he thought. The north-facing gate was scratched and scarred from a battering ram, and the ground in front of it was torn up with what Roran recognized as the tracks of battle. Three catapults, four ballistae, of the sort he had knowledge of from his time on the Dragon Wing, and two ramshackle siege towers were arrayed before the outer wall. A handful of men hunkered next to the machines of war, smoking pipes and playing dice on patches of leather. The machines appeared pitifully inadequate compared with the monolithic mass of the city. The low, flat land surrounding Aros sloped downward toward the sea. Hundreds of farms dotted the green plain, each marked by a wooden fence and at least one thatched hut. Sumptuous estates stood here and there, sprawling stone manors protected by their own high walls, and Roran assumed by their own guards. No doubt they belonged to the nobles of Aros, and perhaps certain well-off merchants. "What do you think?" he asked Khan. The magician shook his head, his drooping eyes even more mournful than usual. "We might as well lay siege to a mountain, for all the good it'll do." "Indeed," observed Brigman, walking up to them. Roran kept his own observations to himself. He did not want the others to know how discouraged he was. "Nasawade is mad if she believes we can capture Aros with only 800 men. If I had 8,000, and Aragorn and Saphira to boot, then I might be sure of it. But not like this." Yet he knew he had to find a way, for Katrina's sake, if nothing else. Without looking at him, Roran said to Brigman, "Tell me about Aros." Brigman twisted his spear several times, grinding the butt of it into the ground before he replied, "Galbatorix had foresight. He saw to it that the city was fully stocked with food before we cut off the roads between here and the rest of the Empire. Water, as you can see, they have no shortage of. Even if we diverted the canals, they would still have several springs and wells inside the city. They could conceivably hold out until winter, if not longer, although I'd wager they'd be right sick of eating turnips before all was said and done. Also, Galbatorix garrisoned Aros with a fair number of soldiers, more than twice what we have, in addition to their usual contingent." "How do you know this?" "An informant. However, he had no experience with military strategy, and he provided us with an overly confident assessment of Aros' weaknesses." "Ah. He also promised us that he would be able to let a small force of men into the city under the cover of dark." "And?" "We waited, but he never appeared, and we saw his head mounted over the parapet the following morning. It's still there, by the eastern gate." "So it is. Are there other gates besides these five?" "Aye, three more. By the docks there's a water gate wide enough for all three streams to run out at once, and next to it a dry gate for men and horses. Then there's another dry gate over at that end." He pointed toward the western side of the city. "Same as the others." "Can any of them be breached?" "Not quickly. By the shore, we haven't room to manoeuvre properly or withdraw out of range of the soldiers' stones and arrows. That leaves us with these gates and the western one as well. The lay of the land is much the same all around the city, except for the shore, so I chose to concentrate our attack on the nearest gate." "What are they made of?" "Iron and oak.
They'll stand for hundreds of years unless we knock them down.
Are they protected by any spells?
I wouldn't know.
Seeing as our Lady Nessawada didn't see fit to send one of her magicians with us.
Halsted has...
Halsted?
Lord Halsted, ruler of Aros. You must have heard of him.
No.
A brief pause followed, wherein Roran could sense Brigman's contempt for him growing. Then the man continued,
Halsted has a conjurer of his own, a mean, sallow-looking creature we've seen atop the walls, muttering into his beard and trying to strike us down with his spells. He seems to be singularly incompetent, because he hasn't had much luck, save for two of the men I had on the battering ram, whom he managed to set on fire.
Roran exchanged glances with Khan. The magician appeared even more worried than before, but he decided it would be better to discuss the matter in private.
"Would it be easier to break through the gates on the canals?" he asked.
"Where would you stand? Look how they're recessed within the wall, without so much as a step for purchase. What's more, there are slits and trapdoors in the roof of the entryway, so they can pour boiling oil, drop boulders, or fire crossbows at anyone foolish enough to venture in there."
"The gates can't be solid all the way down, or they would block the water."
"You're right about that. Below the surface is a latticework of wood and metal, with holes large enough that they don't impede the flow overly much."
"I see.
Are the gates kept lowered into the water most of the time, even when Aros isn't under siege?"
"At night, for certain. But I believe they were left open during the daylight hours."
"Hmm. And what of the walls?"
Brigman shifted his weight.
"Granite, polished smooth, and fits so closely together you can't even slide a knife blade between the blocks. Dwarf work, I'd guess, from before the Fall of the Riders. I'd also guess that the walls are filled with packed rubble, but I can't say for sure since we haven't cracked the outer sheathing yet. They extend at least 12 feet below ground, and probably more, which means we can't tunnel under them or weaken them with sapping."
Stepping forward, Brigman pointed at the manors to the north and west. "Most of the nobles have retreated into Aros, but they left men behind to protect their property. They've given us some trouble, attacking our scouts, stealing our horses, that sort of thing. We captured two of the estates early on." He indicated a pair of burnt-out husks a few miles away. "But holding them was more trouble than it was worth, so we sacked them and put them to the torch. Unfortunately, we don't have enough men to secure the rest."
Baldur spoke then.
"Why do the canals feed into Aros? It doesn't look as if they're used for watering crops."
"You don't need to water here, lad, any more than a Northman needs to cart in snow during the winter. Staying dry is more a problem than not."
"Then what are they used for?" Roran inquired. "And where do they come from? You can't expect me to believe the water is drawn from the Jeet River so many leagues away."
"Hardly," scoffed Brigman.
"There are lakes in the marshes north of us. It's brackish, unwholesome water, but the people here are accustomed to it. A single channel carries it from the marshes to a point about 3 miles away. There the channel divides into the three canals you see here, and they run over a series of falls which power the mills that grind flour for the city. The peasants cart their grain to the mills at harvest time, and then the sacks of flour are loaded onto barges and floated down to Aros. It's also a handy way of moving other goods, like timber and wine, from the manor houses to the city."
Roran rubbed the back of his neck as he continued to examine Aros. What Brigman had told him intrigued him, but he was not sure how it could help.
"Is there anything else of significance in the surrounding countryside?" he asked.
"Only a slate mine, farther south along the coast."
He grunted, still thinking.
"I want to visit the mills," he said. "But first, I want to hear a full account of your time here, and I want to know how well provisioned we are with everything from arrows to biscuits."
"If you'll follow me, Stronghammer."
The next hour, Roran spent in conference with Brigman and two of his lieutenants, listening and asking questions as they recounted each of the assaults they had launched against the city walls, as well as cataloguing the stocks of supplies left to the warriors under his command.
"At least we're not short of weapons," Roran thought, as he counted the number of dead.
Yet even if Nessawada had not set a time limit upon his mission, the men and horses did not have enough food to stay camped before Aros for more than another week. Many of the facts and figures that Brigman and his lackeys related came from writing on scrolls of parchment. Roran strove to conceal the fact that he could not decipher the rows of angular black marks by insisting that the men read everything to him. But it irritated him that he was at the mercy of others. Asawada was right, he realized. I have to learn to read, else I cannot tell if someone is lying to me when they say that a piece of parchment says one thing or another. Maybe Khan can teach me on our return to the Varden. The more Roran learned about Aros, the more he began to sympathize with Brigman's plight. Capturing the city was a daunting task, with no obvious solution. Despite his dislike for the man, Roran thought that the captain had done as well as could be expected under the circumstances. He had failed, Roran believed, not because he was an incompetent commander, but because he lacked the two qualities that had granted Roran victory time and time again: daring and imagination. Upon finishing his review, Roran and his five companions rode with Brigman to inspect Aros's walls and gates from a closer but still safe distance. Sitting in a saddle again was incredibly painful for Roran, but he bore it without complaint. As their steeds clattered onto the stone-paved road next to the camp and began to trot toward the city, Roran noticed that on occasion the horse's hoofs produced a peculiar noise when they struck the ground. He remembered hearing a similar sound and being bothered by it during their final day of travelling. Looking down, he saw that the flat stones that formed the surface of the road seemed to be set within tarnished silver, the veins of which formed an irregular cobweb-like pattern. Roran called out to Brigman and asked him about it, whereupon Brigman shouted, "The dirt here makes for poor mortar, so instead they use lead to hold the stones in place." Roran's initial reaction was disbelief, but Brigman appeared serious. He found it astonishing that any metal could be so common that people would squander it on building a road. So they trotted down the lane of stone and lead toward the gleaming city beyond. They studied Aros's defences with great attentiveness, but their increased proximity revealed nothing new, and only served to reinforce Roran's impression that the city was nigh on impregnable. He guided his horse over to Khan's. The magician was staring at Aros with a glazed expression, his lips moving silently as if he were talking to himself. Roran waited until he stopped, then quietly asked, "Are there any spells on the gates?"
"I think so," Khan replied, equally subdued. "But I'm not sure how many, or what their intended purpose is. I'll need more time to tease out the answers."
"Why is it so difficult?"
"It's not, really. Most spells are easy to detect, unless someone has made an effort to hide them. And even then, the magic usually leaves certain telltale traces, if you know what to look for. My concern is that one or more of the spells might be traps, set to prevent people from meddling with the gate's enchantments. If that's so, and I approach them directly, I'll be sure to trigger them. And who knows what will happen? I might dissolve into a puddle before your very eyes, which is a fate I would rather avoid if I had my way."
"Do you want to stay here while we continue on?" Khan shook his head.
"I don't think it would be wise to leave you unguarded while we're away from camp. I'll return after sundown and see what I can do then. Besides, it would help if I were closer to the gates, and I don't dare go any nearer now, when I'm in plain sight of the sentinels."
"As you wish." When Roran was satisfied they had learned everything they could by looking at the city, he had Brigman lead them to the nearest set of mills. They were much as Brigman had described. The water in the canal flowed over three consecutive 20-foot falls. At the base of each fall was a water wheel, edged with buckets. The water splashed into the buckets, driving the machine round and round. The wheels were connected by thick axles to three identical buildings that stood stacked one above the other along the terraced bank, and which contained the massive grindstones needed to produce the flour for Aros's population. Though the wheels were moving, Roran could tell they were disengaged from the complex arrangement of gears hidden inside the buildings, for he did not hear the rumble of the grindstones turning in their places. He dismounted by the lowest mill and walked up the path between the buildings, eyeing the sluice gates that were above the falls and that controlled the amount of water released into them. The gates were open, but a deep pool of water still lay beneath each of the three slowly spinning wheels. He stopped halfway up the hill and planted his feet on the edge of the soft grassy bank, crossed his arms, and tucked his chin against his chest, while he pondered how he could possibly capture Aros. That there was a trick or a strategy that would allow him to crack open the city like a ripe gourd, he was confident, but the solution eluded him. He thought until he was tired of thinking, and then he gave himself over to the creaking of the turning axles and the splashing of the falling water. Soothing as those sounds were, a thorn of unease still rankled him, for the place reminded him of Dempton's mill in Therensford, where he had gone to work the day the Razak had burned down his home and tortured his father, mortally wounding him. Roran tried to ignore the memory, but it stayed with him, twisting in his gut. If only I had waited another few hours to leave, I could have saved him. Then the more practical part of Roran replied, "Yes, and the Razak would have killed me before I could have even raised a hand. Without Aragorn to protect me, I would have been as helpless as a newborn babe." With a quiet step, Baldur joined him by the edge of the canal. "The others are wondering. Have you decided on a plan?" he asked. "I have ideas, but no plan. What of you?" Baldur crossed his arms as well. "We could wait for Nasawada to send Aragorn and Saphira to our aid." "Bah!" For a while they watched the never-ending motion of the water below them. Then Baldur said, "What if you just ask them to surrender? Maybe they'll be so frightened when they hear your name, they'll throw open the gates, fall at your feet, and beg for mercy." Roran chuckled briefly. "I doubt word of me has reached all the way to Aros. Still," he ran his fingers through his beard, "it might be worth a try, to put them off balance, if nothing else. Even if we gain entrance to the city, can we hold it with so few men?" "Maybe, maybe not." A pause grew between them. Then Baldur said, "How far we have come." "Aye." Again, the only sound was that of the water and of the turning wheels. Finally, Baldur said, "The snow melt must not be as great here as it is at home. Otherwise the wheels would be half under water come springtime." Roran shook his head. "It doesn't matter how much snow or rain they get. The sluice gates can be used to limit the amount of water that runs over the wheels, so they don't turn too fast. But once the water rises to the top of the gates? Hopefully the day's grinding is finished by then. But in any case, you uncouple the gears, raise the gates, and..." Roran trailed off as a series of images flashed through his mind, and his whole body flushed with warmth, as if he had drunk an entire tankard of mead in a single gulp. "Could I?" he thought wildly. "Would it really work, or..." "It doesn't matter. We have to try. What else can we do?" He strode out to the centre of the berm that held back the middlemost pond, and grasped the spokes that stuck out from the tall wooden screw used to raise and lower the sluice gate. The screw was stiff and hard to move, even though he set his shoulder against it and pushed with all his weight. "Help me," he said to Baldur, who had remained on the bank, watching with puzzled interest. Baldur carefully made his way to where Roran stood. Together, they managed to close the sluice gate. Then, refusing to answer any questions, Roran insisted that they do the same with both the uppermost and the lowermost gates. When all three were firmly shut, Roran walked back to Karn, Brigman, and the others, and motioned for them to climb off their horses and gather around him. He tapped the head of his hammer while he waited, suddenly feeling unreasonably impatient. "Well?" Brigman demanded once they were in place. Roran looked each of them in the eyes to make sure that he had their undivided attention. Then he said, "Right, this is what we're going to do." And he began to talk quickly and intensely for a full half hour, explaining everything that had occurred to him in that one revelatory instant. As he spoke, Mandel began to grin, and though they remained more serious, Baldur, Delwyn, and Hammond also appeared excited by the audacious nature of the scheme he outlined. Their response gratified Roran. He had done much to earn their trust, and he was pleased to know that he could still count on their support. His only fear was that he might let them down, Of all the fates he could imagine, only losing Katrina seemed worse. Khan, on the other hand, appeared somewhat doubtful. This Roran had expected, but the magician's doubt was slight compared with Brigman's incredulity.
"You're mad!" he exclaimed once Roran had finished. "It'll never succeed!"
"You take that back," said Mandel,
and jumped forward, his fists clenched.
"Why, Roran's won more battles than you've ever fought in, and he did it without all the warriors you've had to order around."
Brigman snarled, his bare upper lip curling like a snake.
"You little whelp! I'll teach you a lesson in respect you'll never forget."
Roran pushed Mandel back before the younger man could attack Brigman.
"Oi!" growled Roran. "Behave yourself."
With a surly look, Mandel ceased resisting, but he continued to glower at Brigman, who sneered at him in return.
"It's an outlandish plan, to be sure," said Delwyn, "but then your outlandish plans have served us well in the past."
The other men from Carvajal made sounds of agreement. Khan nodded and said,
"Maybe it will work, and maybe it won't. I don't know. In any event, it's certain to catch our enemies by surprise, and I have to admit, I'm rather curious to see what will happen. Nothing like this has ever been tried before."
Roran smiled slightly. Addressing Brigman, he said,
"To continue as before, now that would be mad. We have only 2.5 days to seize Aros. Ordinary methods won't suffice, so we must hazard the extraordinary."
"That may be," muttered Brigman.
"But this is a ridiculous venture that will kill many a good man, and for no reason other than to demonstrate your supposed cleverness."
His smile widening, Roran moved toward Brigman until only a few inches separated them.
"You don't have to agree with me, Brigman. You only have to do what you're told. Now, will you follow my orders or not?"
The air between them grew warm from their breath and from the heat radiating off their skin. Brigman gritted his teeth and twisted his spear even more vigorously than before. But then his gaze wavered, and he backed away.
"Blast you," he said. "I'll be your dog for the while, Stronghammer. But there'll be a reckoning on this soon enough, just you watch, and then you'll have to answer for your decisions."
"As long as we capture Aros," thought Roran, "I don't care."
"Mount up," he shouted. "We have work to do, and little time to do it in. Hurry, hurry, hurry!"